This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Late last week, the U.S. Census Bureau released its official poverty figures for 2002, and the picture is bleak. For the second straight year, the number of people living in poverty increased. The Bureau says almost 35 million people now live below the poverty line. But what exactly does the government mean by living below the poverty line? Well, back in 1965, the Johnson administration adopted a formula for calculating poverty. The Department of Agriculture estimated a family's annual food budget and multiplied that by three because it was believed that most families spent a third of their household income on food. Using that formula with adjustments for inflation, the government now says a family of four with an income of $18,392 is living in poverty. This number is important and politically charged because it determines who's eligible for government programs such as food stamps or Head Start. But critics say the government calculations are outdated and do not get at the real problem of what it means to be poor in this country. What's your definition of poverty? How much do you think a family of four needs to live well in this country? Does it change from state to state, city to city? Do you live at or perhaps just above the official poverty line? Do you consider yourself to be poor? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We also have an email challenge this hour. Give us an actual dollar amount. What is the poverty line for where you live? Email your suggestions to TOTN at npr.org. And joining us now is Alice O'Connor. She's a history professor at the University of California in Santa Barbara. She studies U.S. public policy and is currently a fellow at the Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History at Harvard. She joins us from their studios there in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
Alice, I just gave a little nutshell there of the history of how the government determines the official poverty line, but maybe you could fill us in a bit more. I understand, first of all, it was a government employee who first figured out this calculation. Is that right?
That's right. Her name was Molly Orshansky, and she was an employee. She was a lifetime civil servant who had initially worked for the Department of Agriculture, but at the time that she came up with the poverty measure was at the Social Security Administration.
And why did she decide to try and figure this out? She kind of did it on her own, didn't she?
Well, yes, and this is one of the interesting parts of the story. Molly Orshansky did not set out to come up with an official poverty line. She was working on a larger project at the Social Security Administration to try to understand what was happening to children in families without fathers. Essentially, what the Social Security Administration was trying to understand was the difference between the children of the mothers who had been never married or divorced, and children who in families where the mother was widowed. Those children were getting survivor's benefits from Social Security versus the children of divorced or never married mothers who were getting support from the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program. So that was the setting for her doing this initial research.
And okay, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in the course of doing this research, given the fact that the government had no official standard for measuring poverty, that was the context within which she came up with her own.
But was it ever intended to have this such staying power?
Not particularly. And again, you know, Molly Orshansky used a standard measure. She used a standard procedure for coming up with her poverty standard. That is to say, it wasn't the first time someone had gone out to use some kind of standard of living, usually based on some kind of budget for what it costs to clothe a family, feed a family, et cetera, et cetera. So she used available data and some standard practices. But never thought in the course of doing this work that this was going to become the official poverty standard.
How did it become the official poverty standard?
Well, another interesting part of the story, which underscores the fact that It's really the politics, the political basis of these decisions that we need to be paying attention to, as much as the so-called scientific validity of these measures. It became the official poverty standard because as she is working on this project in 1963, the President's Council of Economic Advisors were working under a mandate to come up with a plan for fighting what became known as the War on Poverty, for fighting and winning, by the way, the War on Poverty. At that time, in 1963, again, there's no official poverty standard, the Council of Economic Advisors used pretty much a flat rate of $3,000 that would cover all families, regardless of where they lived, regardless of whether it was an elderly couple or a family with four children or more. That became the sort of working definition of poverty, admittedly a flawed one. Fast forward then to 1964, 1965, when the War on Poverty is up and running, and critics as well as supporters are scrutinizing, well, what do we mean by poverty? How are we going to win this war? And especially, how are we going to know when we've won this war? That creates political pressure for an official definition of poverty. The Office of Economic Opportunity, under tremendous political pressure, issued a press release in 1965 announcing that they had discovered and that they were there from there on in going to use and the official poverty measure based on what until then had been a somewhat obscure article that Molly Orshansky had published in 1963.
That's fascinating. And this is a really important figure, isn't it? How does the government use this figure?
Well, in all sorts of ways. Probably politically the most important way is as a sort of standard bearer. How are we doing in the economy? At the time, in the 1960s, of course, it's how are we doing in the war against poverty? Now it's become more a measure of, you know, a general economic well-being that people are watching out for, especially within the context right now of welfare reform.
So that's no administration wants to see a really high poverty rate because it's going to look bad.
Absolutely. And, you know, it may get to the point where it becomes hard to defend economic and welfare policies if you see the poverty rate rising. On the other hand, an especially important use, you know, has a direct implications for the way people live and how they can get along, because this standard is used in determining all sorts of eligibility for social welfare benefits.
Yeah. And is there agreement now? Do people feel that this calculation should be changed, or is there a satisfaction with the status quo? This really is a good figure for determining who is living in poverty?
Now, I would say there's widespread agreement among the people who do research on poverty and who administer programs, for that matter, who pay attention to the poverty rate, that this is a deeply flawed measure. In fact, Molly Orshansky herself felt that this was a rather flawed measure of poverty, and she herself was quite surprised and somewhat skeptical at the adoption of her poverty measure. She considered it something that, you know, she had come up with. It was an interim measure. It sort of worked for practical purposes. But even at the time, even in the early 1960s, she was aware that this measure of food adequacy that she was basing it on was extraordinarily minimalistic, and she herself wrote about that. And over time, as many have suggested, it's become even more minimalistic, even more of an understatement of what a family actually needs to get by, for among other reasons, that it doesn't take it into account crucial costs of living, such as child care, such as transportation, such as housing in particular, which has become a much bigger part of the family budget than it was back in the early 1960s.
If you'll stay with us a minute, Alice, we're going to bring another guest in now. Dan Weinberg is chief of the Housing and Household Economic Statistics Division with the U.S. Census Bureau. Thanks for being with us, Dan.
Glad to be here.
Dan, first of all, Are there other definitions that the Census Bureau has looked at, except for the one that we're talking about now, the one that has been around for the last four decades?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we've done a number of experimental studies to provide that information to the public. Let me tell you, some of the common criticisms are that we don't take account of the growth of non-cash benefits such as food stamps. The official poverty measure doesn't take account of taxes. As you mentioned earlier, there are differences across geographical areas in the cost of living. There are a number of ways to take advantage of, to understand those a little bit more, and we've developed some experimental measures.
They're just experimental at this point, though. I mean, the official calculation is still the one that was arrived at almost 40 years ago. Is that right?
That's right. The Office of Management and Budget has a statistical policy directive they established in about 1969, and we follow those that directive to get the official poverty rate.
Yeah. Now, the alternatives that you've looked at, can you give us an example of the kind of difference you might see in terms of determining the poverty level, calculating some of those other things? Take, for instance, regional differences.
Sure. There was an important study completed in 1995 by the National Academy of Sciences that made a number of recommendations, some of which are relatively non-controversial, like counting the value of food stamps. Some of them are controversial, like should we adjust the thresholds for geographical differences? And they suggested taking account of the differences in housing costs. But that doesn't always mean a big difference in the estimate. Just for example, in 2002, the official measure of poverty gave you a poverty rate of 12.1%. The range, if we do not take account of geographical differences, was 12.4 to 13%. The range, if we do, is 12.3 to 12.9. So there's not really a big effect on the overall poverty rate from taking account of geographical differences. Now, there are differences in a number of states.
All right. Let's take a call. Peter in Sunnyvale, California, give us a call. You're on Talk of the Nation. Hi. Peter? Hello, Peter. You're on Talk of the Nation. I guess Peter is not there at the moment. Let's see if we can take another call. Eugene in Albany, Oregon. Eugene, hi.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I own a business in Oregon here. I own a brewery, and I work probably 60 hours a week or so. And I can't seem to pay myself as much as I would like. You know, I make well under the minimum wage. And the problem I'm having is that it would be helpful if I could get some minimal services as far as maybe a little bit of food stamp assistance or some insurance benefits through the state, but I don't seem to be able to qualify for those because they count all the business income as my own personal income, which really puts me in a bind. So I don't know how the rules differ.
So are the rules different? And maybe I guess Dan Weinberg, you could answer that. Are the rules different for people who own their own businesses as opposed to someone who's on a salary, or how does that work?
Each federal program sets up its own rules for eligibility. What counts as income, how many assets you can have, that sort of thing. So it's not, I can't give an answer that goes across all programs.
Okay. Well,
does that answer your question, Dan, or do you have a further question?
Well, it was just basically a comment in that, you know, even though I do work hard and put in a lot of hours and still can't seem to make ends meet, they just are unfair in the way they apply, or, you know, they consider income that goes towards running the business as my personal income,
yeah,
which gives me puts me at a very big disadvantage over most people. I'd almost be better off selling my business and getting a minimum wage job and then being able to qualify for benefits or whatever.
Interesting point. Thanks so much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you to Daniel Weinberg, Chief of the Housing and Household Economic Statistics Division in the U.S. Census Bureau, also Alice O'Connor, Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're talking about how we define poverty. We'll be taking your calls when we return. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Last week, the U.S. Census Bureau released its annual poverty figures and found a rise in poverty for the second straight year. Today, we're looking at how we define poverty in this country. Is a 40-year-old definition still appropriate, or does that definition need to be changed? You're invited to join the discussion. What questions do you have about how the poverty line is determined? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. The Census Bureau counts poverty using the threshold of $18,000 for a family of four. What's the minimum amount of money you think a family of four needs to live in your neighborhood? Email those responses to totn@npr.org. And we are joined now in Studio 3A by Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks for being with us, Jared.
My pleasure.
And Doug Besheroff. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good to have you here as well.
Thanks a lot.
Jared, let's start with you. Do you think that this official measurement we've been talking about is really an accurate portrayal of poverty in the United States?
Oh, far from it. I think you'd have a very hard time finding anyone who would defend the official measure, as I think you probably heard in the last segment. And what's important is that we have considerably better measures of poverty that are being experimented with and used as alternatives at the Census Bureau. But it's a bit of a political hot potato to adapt a better measure, because almost any improved measure would show higher poverty rates than the official. So no administration wants to embrace that on their watch.
And how would you change it?
I would change it much in the ways that have been reflected by the National Academy of Sciences. Sciences have given the mandate to come up with a better approach to measurement. I would be much more comprehensive in calculating family income. I'd include the value of non-cash benefits such as food stamps, health insurance on the income side. By the way, that by itself would lower measured poverty rates,
because
it make people's incomes look higher. But on the expense side, and this is key, especially in today's economy, I would subtract from income the expenses associated with the cost of work. Child care is one that I like to focus on, because I think it's such an important and considerable expenditure for working families. And it's an expenditure that's obviously a very necessary one, particularly in the policy framework nowadays, where it's all about welfare to work and making sure families are in the labor market, a movement that I think is worthy of support. But at the same time, I think it's a fair and reasonable and I think accurate to reflect the cost, the expenses that are incurred in such work in the poverty rate. And as I said, there is an alternative measure that does a good job of incorporating those factors, and that would get you up to closer to 15% poverty, not 12.
It was interesting. I don't know if you heard the call. We had a caller who is self-employed, owns his own business, was saying he'd like to get a little government help, but it wouldn't work for him. How would you respond to that?
I heard that call. My sense was that this was a person who would probably fall victim what's called to the asset test, and I think the asset test is a problem with our food stamps program. That is, this guy's income sounded like it might have been low enough to qualify for food stamps, but he had too many assets. And interestingly, there are poor people throughout this country who, maybe because they have a car, which is worth $5,000, $8,000, something like that, they're not allowed to get food stamps because the value of their car in some states is considered part of their wealth, and it puts them over the top. So there are problems with the way these policies are, the means test, as they call it, the tests involved with eligibility for some of these policies. By the way, there's movement afoot to change that asset test.
Doug Besheroff, let's bring you into the conversation. Do you think we do need to change the current official definition of poverty?
Well, I think we could use many definitions of poverty. I think no definition is perfect. Every definition will create its own distortions. We're talking here about the problem with assets. The person who called owned a brewery, as far as I could tell. I think it's not just a $5,000 car. The proposal that Jared mentioned, which is to include the cost of child care and so forth, would help us understand one part of low-income America, but it might distort other kinds of questions. For example, families where someone doesn't work, where it's not a single mother, where they need child care and so forth. So my own view about this is, I don't want to say the more the merrier, but I think the more the richer the discourse. And one thing that we forget in these conversations, we tend to think about the poverty measure for what it's publicly known to do, which is get a headline in the papers when it goes up or goes down.
Right.
It is actually the basis for the distribution of government money around the country. And so the real issue that has stymied the Congress, I think, is not just the political one of left and right, but it is the states. Any change in the poverty measure means that different states will get different amounts of federal aid. And that's been the killer.
Can you outline what you mean by that for people who, I think a lot of people may not understand this. What are some of the programs we're talking about that that people become eligible for based on whether or not they are living below the poverty line, according to the government?
Well, it's not just, the poverty line is used as the measure, but
right.
sometimes it's 115% of the poverty line, sometimes it's 185%.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it means 15% more than the, say, the $18,000 for a family of four, or 50% more, but they're all keyed to the poverty line. In other words, many benefits are mm-hmm. provided, for example, Medicaid, to families above the poverty line, but they're measured as multiples of the poverty line. That means that a high poverty measured state, for example, in the West, might get more benefits than a, if you're doing just on the dollar amounts, someplace like New York, because incomes are higher.
So this really isn't we're not really talking about what it means to be poor here. We're really talking just about a number that's used in a very specific way by the government. It doesn't really talk about what is poverty, does it?
Well, I'd say we're talking about both. I mean, I guess I don't totally agree with Doug's point about sort of let a thousand measures bloom, because that will help social scientists understand things better. Right now, I think we actually have a plethora of alternatives, and I find that many of the reporters I've been speaking to around these issues get confused by how many alternatives are out there. I think there is a need to have somewhat of an objective sense as to how many people are poor in this country, so we can understand the economic progress that we've made or haven't made. And then there's this other issue, which is, as Doug appropriately raises, who gets benefits. Now, I think Doug made an interesting point. At this point, take CHIP, the Child Health Insurance Program. It's basically Medicaid for poor kids. Eligibility for CHIP goes up to 200% of poverty at the state level. That is, instead of having $18,000, you'd have a family could have $36,000 and qualify for CHIP for their kids, though not for their parents. This means that administrators, officials, folks who are making these decisions are already throwing the poverty line out, because they're not saying eligibility is based on poverty, say eligibility based on twice poverty.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's a real dramatic example of how obsolete this measure is. As I said, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone to defend it.
We're talking about the way the government defines and measures poverty. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Mary in Oklahoma City. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Go ahead.
You started out in your introduction using the definition of a family of four as the standard kind of for, or the baseline of where a family begins when talking about poverty. And my question is, how did that develop? And I have worked with various agencies, and one of the things that seems to be a constant when I've worked with women trying to struggle to raise children, or families trying to struggle to raise children on very limited incomes, is they don't seem to get the correlation so many times between children and poverty, that actually having children creates poverty, and that children seem to be kind of almost a given right to have and bear without really realizing that your income will not go up because you have children, and you will begin to suffer a
well, I should point
quality of life.
I should clarify something for you, Mary. We did use the family of four figure, which is a standard figure that's thrown out, but there are figures for individuals, for families of three. I think do you have those figures there, Jared?
Yeah.
Hold on a sec.
You mentioned that it's $18,000 is the threshold for a family of four. For a family of three, say a mom with two kids, the threshold is about $14,500. A parent with three kids, you're looking at about $21,500. So Mary is right that the poverty threshold, and therefore the likelihood of being poor, does rise as the number of kids goes up. The thresholds are adjusted for that.
But why don't we, if you don't mind, I think I would amend Jared's statement to say being considered poor. I think the question here is mm-hmm. if someone has three children, I think what Mary is asking is someone has three children, four children, five children, then I think the poverty line for five children is around $36,000, if I remember correctly. There's a mismatch between that salary and the concept of poverty. Now, what the poverty measure does is it adds in a requirement of having to have extra income if you have more kids. And so many people look at this and say, well, wait a minute. Now, part of it's not a large part, but part of, quote, our poverty problem is because people have more children than they can afford to raise on their own. And I'm not into whether they should or not, but it's one of the conundrums that leads me to think we need many different measures of poverty, because some folks would say, I don't want to consider someone with five kids and a salary of $32,000 a year poor. That is not poor. That is having a tough time. It's a difficult row to hoe, but that's not poverty. That's something else.
All right, let's take another call. We have Carol in Reno, Nevada. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Hi, I have a comment about the poverty level. I'm single with no children, earning $18,000 a year. I'm working two part-time jobs, building my career, and so knowing that I need to kind of start out on the bottom, so I'm okay for doing that for now. But I have to live with a roommate. There is no way that I could afford rent and utilities and everything on my own. And gosh, you know what? I feel like it's a luxury when I go out and buy a pair of jeans, and my car is on its last legs, and I don't know what I'm going to do when it breaks down and I finally have to get a new car, because I don't know how I can even afford one.
So do you feel like you're living in poverty? Would you describe that as poverty?
I would say if it's not poverty, it's pretty close.
Well, we've done, this is Jared Bernstein, we've done a good deal of research on the kinds of problems that the caller's raising. The poverty rate is probably inadequate to capture the hardships, the difficulties that people face just by dint of having incomes that are too low to meet their needs. So, for example, here you're talking about someone who is whose income is about twice the poverty line for an individual, yet she has difficulty paying rent, has to have a roommate. There's a considerable gap between the earnings and the needs of many families in this country, and you'd have to go up to twice the poverty line. Instead of talking about rates of 12%, you'd probably be looking at rates closer to 20% if you actually looked at the families who have difficulty meeting their basic needs, making their expenditures go the distance. Now, I think in the concept of Doug was talking about a minute ago, these are not people who are suffering severe material deprivation or deep hardships, but they are people who are having difficulties much like the caller. And in that sense, it's not poor, but it is there is a gap between what they earn and what they need.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. And I should follow up that with reading a couple of emails here. This one is from Boston. Realistically, anything below $50,000 is uncomfortable enough to qualify for poverty here in Boston. And from San Francisco, I've heard the poverty line for a small family is $76,000 per year in the Bay Area. This seems accurate to me. We have a household income of $130,000, and we cannot afford to buy a decent three-bedroom home in a decent neighborhood here. Does that qualify as poverty to you, either of you?
Well, there is a part of this, the more serious part of this, is that as a society, we've raised our expectations about what a decent standard of living is for an American. I mean, there is a joke, I think it's probably not true. Gorbachev was over here and he was being shown some American slums, and someone said, if that's a slum, I'll take 10 of them. So the expectations of how an American should live, whether someone should have to live with a roommate or should be able to have his or her own apartment, color our view of what it is to be poor. And that's why I think we could never come to an agreement about what is or is not the one and only poverty line. We should look at all of these differences and make a judgment about what it takes for a family to make do.
Douglas Besheroff is resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institution. We're also joined today by Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK.
You know, Doug has said numerous times, you know, we can't decide on the best measure, and I'm sympathetic to that viewpoint. However, the fact is that we implicitly or explicitly have decided. We have this official poverty rate. It's one that nobody believes in, and it's one that doesn't present an accurate, reliable view of A, who's poor, and B, who's in need of safety net services. So the fact that we've settled on a lousy one by no means should preclude us from coming up with a much better one.
All right, let's take another call. Roberta in San Francisco. Hi, Roberta.
Hi there. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Good. Say, I guess my point was kind of about the last caller. I'm not in Reno. I'm in San Francisco, one of the number one necessary, I guess, number one cities in America that where you need income. I'm an college-educated professional who is making $33,000 a year, and every national, I've seen national and local pieces of information that in order to survive, and they're talking survive in San Francisco, you have to make at least $70,000 or $72,000.
Yeah, we just had an email to that effect as well.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, my point, I guess, is that we do need to look at this because, I mean, it almost, you need to go state by state, not even regionally. I mean, because Nevada would pull our western region way down, and so would Oregon. No offense either state. I love both of them, in fact. But my point is that, you know, it's kind of like the same idea in the previous, I think it was email about not being able to get a decent home. I mean, for gosh sakes, you know, there are a lot of issues that America needs to look at. And if there's a poverty level, my thought is, if you're at X poverty level in Y state, then you shouldn't have to pay federal income tax. I just am thinking, you know, why, you know, here I am. I haven't even made about $27,000 this year, and I've paid in over $3,000 of that in taxes.
Okay, Roberta, I'm going to ask our guests to respond to your comments. We've already talked about this a little bit. I think it really gets to the point you made of us raising the bar, the country as a whole, raising the bar. But what we haven't talked about, and I'm not sure $76,000 a year really qualifies as this either, is people who live who are just above what is the official poverty line of $18,000 a year for a family of four, the working poor. And there are official definitions for that as well, aren't there? Up to like $30,000 a year or something like that?
Not an official definition,
no.
Although many analysts, I know myself, include up to twice the poverty line, so getting up to about $36,000 for working families. And that's based on a set of analyses that looks at what people need to meet their basic needs. And as these callers have suggested, of course those income levels are much higher in San Francisco than they would be in, say, a southern city. And the point is not that these folks are poor. I don't think you could make a case that someone with income in the 70s is poor, but that they do face income constraints in making in keeping up a reasonable standard of living in some of our cities.
Okay. When we return from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation about poverty with our guests, Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and Daniel Weinberg, Douglas Besheroff, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institution. We'll also talk about Pope John Paul II's recent appointment of 31 new cardinals and what that might mean for an eventual succession. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Here are a few stories that NPR News is working on this afternoon. A civilian translator at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba has been arrested for taking classified information from the camp. It's the third case of its type in the last week. Later today, Republican candidate Arianna Huffington will announce her intentions regarding the California recall election scheduled in 1 week. Recent polls show the race is primarily between Arnold Schwarzenegger and and Governor Gray Davis. And I should say that was Arianne Huffington is an independent, not a Republican. These stories will be coming up on All Things Considered from NPR News later this afternoon. Right now on Talk of the Nation, we are discussing poverty and how we define it. My guests are Jared Bernstein, senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and Doug Besheroff, a resident at the American Enterprise Institute and a professor at the University of Maryland. Thanks again for joining us. And if you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to... Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. One of your guests mentioned that, I guess a visitor, I'm not sure if it was a third world country, looked at our ghettos and commented that, well, if this is a ghetto in America, I'll take 10 of them. And often you hear on the guys on the right compare America's standards to third world countries. But if you compare it to Europe, or often Europeans come here, Northern Europeans and Western Europeans, and they look at our poverty rate, and they say they're just shocked, the poverty in America. So if you compare it to Western Europe, I mean, this 12,000 with a family of four, I mean, that's absurd.
I mean, it was 18,000. But
was it 18,000?
Yeah.
Still absurd.
Okay, Jared Bernstein.
Well, Tom raises an important point. Interestingly, in Europe, what's called the pre-transfer poverty rates, that is the rate of poverty that the market by itself delivers, is pretty similar to what we have here. But of course, they have a much more extensive safety net. So what is aghast to many European policy analysts is the fact that we're looking at child poverty rates in the 16% range, 12 million kids who are poor, poor by a measure that I think significantly understates the extent of poverty. This is a huge national problem that has long-term costs, because growing up poor creates such a difficult life for these kids later on down the road. So I think the more extensive European safety net, which Tom is referencing, is something that we need to think much more about in our context.
All right, thanks for your call, Tom. Let's go to Dory in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi, Dory.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
We're well below the poverty line. There's three of us, my husband and my son and myself. We make between $12,000 and $14,000 a year. We don't have credit cards. We don't have cable. We don't watch television. We use the clothesline. About the only time we really have money constraints is when one of us is sick, because we have no health insurance whatsoever. Also, we pay our own taxes because my husband is considered an independent contractor.
Do you own your own home, or do you rent?
No, we're renting. Our rent is currently half our income right now. But our groceries are less than a seventh, because I'm a stay-at-home mom. I can look for the best deals. I cook from scratch, and we don't go out and eat, hardly ever.
So are you saying, do you consider yourself to be living in poverty? Or?
Not really. Actually, I think we're living quite well. I love the place that we're renting, but with our income, we're never going to own a home, and we've pretty much given up on that one. But through really being diligent with what funds are available to us, we have a pretty good lifestyle. I don't feel poor at all, and until one of us gets sick, and then we get those looks from the bill collector.
And tell me what those looks are.
Oh, great. Here's another poor person we're going to be hunting down for 6 months to get this bill paid. It's not the hospital administration, not at all. But often we do have to deal with people for collections. I will call them ahead of time and say, I'm sorry, we don't have $600 for this. Can we pay you a certain amount a month? And then you hear that sigh. That, all right, here's another poor one we're never going to see a dime out of. And you can't help but hear it. It's there. It's never been the hospital people, though. They've always treated us with respect the few times we have to go in, but we'll put off a hospital or doctor visit as long as we can until we simply can't stand the pain or our son is in trouble, which he goes in regardless.
Yeah.
But as adults, we'll fight the pain or whatever until we absolutely have to go. That's
right.
The only time I feel poor.
Thanks so much for your call, Dory, because we're going to conclude this discussion now, and I'd like to end on this call because I think Dory raises a couple of very interesting points. Question of health, which we're going to be discussing on this show tomorrow, and lack of insurance benefits. And just also, she really raised that question of what it feels like to really not have enough money at a moment when you really need it.
Well,
and that's really poverty, isn't it?
Well, but what she said reminded me of what, you know, many oldsters say, which is, we weren't poor, we just didn't have any money. She said she didn't feel poor until there were certain bigger expenses. I'd like to finish on a point that Jared made. He said this was the current poverty measure was a lousy measure. Well, you know, it's signaling to us that the economy is having problems. It's signaling to us that incomes are going down. It's showing us where incomes are going down. It's not as lousy as some other measures could be. And I think that's how I'd like to leave this. We have heard tonight from the call-ins that there are many different views of how to measure poverty. Many of them have to do with higher expectations about an American lifestyle. Expectations I share, by the way. But it would be a mistake to call that a poverty issue. That's a how do we make us all live better in America? And that's a different set of problems, I think, than poverty.
Well, I think we need a better measure to help us assess the extent of living standards and material deprivation in the country. And the poverty measure is widely agreed to be vastly inadequate to that task. And we could do a better job today because we have better measures. But let me end with this thought. No matter how you measure poverty, deprivation, living standards, they've been getting worse. We are ensconced right now in a jobless recovery that is really one of the worst recoveries on record in terms of job losses. And any measure shows that. The trend increase in material deprivation, the trend decrease in living standards has been consistent throughout every measure you choose, and that's one of the problems we face right now.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us. Jared Bernstein is a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, and Doug Besheroff, thanks to you as well. Doug is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a professor at the University of Maryland. They both joined us here in Studio 3A.